The Biblical Bare Necessities on Nudity, Modesty, Beauty, and Sex by Garrett Mullett. Published November 21st, 2017. What should our attitude be about things like nudity, modesty, beauty, and sex? For the Christian, what does the Bible say? Where the world around us is desperately lost and the culture within the church sometimes embraces arbitrary traditions and standards without critically examining them, let us resolve to know and live according to the truth. Consider Genesis. Then Yahweh God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." The rib that Yahweh God had taken from the man he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Genesis 2:18 and verses 22 to 24 ESV. First, consider the facts, then the implications. God created our bodies, and maleness and femaleness are neither trivial nor incidental. In the beginning, there are only two people, Adam and Eve. And when God introduces them to one another, it is in the context of marriage. And they are not only naked, they are unashamed of being naked. From this, it seems obvious, too, that God himself has no problem with nudity. Later on in the scriptures, this is stated more bluntly. "No creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account." Hebrews 4:13 ESV. Why then do we wear clothes? As it turns out, God created more than just our bodies. He also made the first decent set of clothing. After Adam and Eve sinned, they tried making clothes out of fig leaves, but these were shabby, so God made them clothes of better stuff, animal skins. And I wonder what the design was for the set God made. How much skin was covered? Was there uniformity between Adam's set and Eve's? Examining the law, we might speculate. "A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. Whoever does these things is an abomination to Yahweh your God." Deuteronomy 22:5 ESV. Maybe this means God made special clothes for Adam and special clothes for Eve. Or perhaps such norms came about later. In any event, I think God is more concerned with attitudes of the heart than this or that cut and color. But I still want to know what the clothing God made was like. Knowing such a thing might go a long way to settling many of our debates about modesty. Muslims wear their burqas. Many jungle tribes all over the world are content with a few strategically placed strips of leather. Who has it right? Or are both extremes wrong? Sadly, we do not find a definite answer in the Bible, but I think that is because the cut and dimensions of clothing are somewhat beside the point to God. Maybe Adam and Eve were both given baggy robes that covered them from chin to wrist and ankle. Maybe they both wore nothing but a loincloth. In any event, we do not know because we do not need to know. All we do know is that they wore clothes after the fall. Yet consider the words of the Apostle Paul. "On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, and on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another." 1 Corinthians 12:22-26 ESV. Paul here is talking about how the body of Christ functions, yet the bit about physical bodies must itself be true for the comparison to the church to be meaningful. Notice what Paul says, "On those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty." It follows that our unpresentable parts are not presented, they are not shown. Paul equates greater modesty with covering up. We must conclude then that modesty in some measure means clothing. Paul also says, "Our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require." This means parts of our bodies are presentable. We can treat those with less modesty. This means, I think, that the Muslims have it wrong in covering every square inch of real estate. We cover the parts of our bodies that are unpresentable. Other parts we can leave uncovered. Yet this still does not tell us which we cover and which we can leave uncovered. Paul writes in another place, I desire then that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with that which is proper for women who profess godliness with good works. 1 Timothy 2, 8-10, ESV. Paul tells the men to lift holy hands during prayer. Then he tells the women how to dress. Why not also tell the women to lift their hands during prayer? And why not tell the men how to dress? The short answer is, I do not know. We also still do not know from this what and how much of the body to cover. Nevertheless, here we have something of a dress code in the phrase, adorn themselves in respectable apparel. This implies women should clothe themselves in a way that people around them respect. Paul also lays out here what the attitude of these women should be in the phrase, with modesty and self-control. He also touches on what it should not be by referencing braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire. He wraps it all up nicely by saying women should adorn themselves with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. This excludes, most notably among other things, sexual immorality. Sexual immorality is not godliness nor good works, and clothing intended to encourage sexual immorality is presumably not respectable apparel, therefore. Yet Paul says nothing of short skirts and low-cut blouses. And when was the last time a contemporary discussion of modesty focused on jewelry and braided hair? Perhaps gold, pearl, and braids were the equivalent of miniskirts and cleavage in that day, but I doubt it. In any event, should every discussion of modesty in the church today fixate exclusively on sexual purity and self-control? Is that merited? Surely a concern for sexual purity is important. Consider Paul's first letter to the church in Thessalonica. This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you know how to control his own body in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, that no one transgress and wrong his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger in all these things, as we told you beforehand and solemnly warned you. 1 Thessalonians 4:3-6, ESV. God opposes sexual immorality among his people. The scriptures are clear about that. It stands to reason, then, that a proper outfit does not promote sexual immorality. But what of beauty? Beauty may not be a good work, but it surely is a good thing. Not once do the scriptures lead us to believe that a person being attractive represents a character flaw. Yet I think the commands against lust and sexual immorality and for modest clothing are often misconstrued as being against the human body generally or against beauty especially. Yet God surely is not opposed to the human body. He designed and created it, and I cannot believe he wants us to despise beauty. I think, too, that this is a place where if a very conservative person says to me, we should err on the side of caution, I reply by asking why we should err at all if we can help it. In any event, if our aim is to rightly divide the word of truth, it behooves us to be careful not to confuse attractiveness with immodesty. Consider Job. He is exceedingly blessed. He has family, wealth, and social status. Yet Satan is allowed by God to test him for a time. Everything Job finds satisfying or enjoyable is destroyed. Even his children die. Yet after all that devastation and much mourning and painfully honest dialogue with God and man, we read this about Job's restoration. Yahweh restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And Yahweh gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before and ate bread with him in his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that Yahweh had brought upon him. Each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. Yahweh blessed the latter days of Job more than the beginning, and he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. He called the name of the first daughter Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Keren Hapuk. In all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. Job 42, 10-15, ESV. Wait a moment. If the saying is true that old beauty is a curse bit, then Job's 3 daughters being the most beautiful women in the land is out of place here. Yet that is just it. Beauty is not a curse, and Job's latter days were counted as more blessed, in part because his daughters were the most beautiful in the land. Surely then God is not opposed to beauty.